Next, we will hear from Félix Germain, who is an assistant professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. He earned his PhD from UC Berkeley, and his work has appeared in French Historical Studies, French Politics, Culture, and Society, and the Journal of African American Studies. His book, Decolonizing the Republic, African and Caribbean Migrants in Postwar Paris, 1946 to 1974, came out with Michigan State Press in 2016, and a volume co-edited with Silène Larcher entitled Black French Women and the Struggle for Equality, 1848 to 2016, is forthcoming with the University of Nebraska's press series on France and France overseas in the fall of 2018. Today he will speak to us about connections between distance, racism, France, and the overseas French Caribbean departments. Félix.
Hi to my colleagues. Thank you for organizing this wonderful event. So notions of distance between French historians and French Caribbean subjects. And here I'm not only referring to the sort of the actual physical distance between most French historians in the US and France and subjects from the French Caribbean. From the French Overseas Department. I'm talking more so about the intellectual, the cultural distance between these scholars and French Caribbean subjects. And so what kind of work do we produce when we do not understand the cultural nuances, the intellectual history of the research subject? And when I say intellectual history, I'm not only referring to the works of French Caribbean intellectuals. Indeed, you know that up until the interwar period, most Antillians from the lower classes were illiterate or semi-illiterate. Members of this group were not imagined as intellectuals, yet a vibrant intellectual tradition also thrived within that segment of the population. So the other question is, could the distance between French historians and French Caribbean intellectual history or culture be related to the fact that we rely strongly on the archives, which do not always give a voice to the vast majority of these semi-literate or illiterate French Caribbean subjects. And so if it is, I would like to offer certain methodological tools allowing us to better understand these French Caribbean identities, transcend the archives as the only or primary source of data so that we can write a more nuanced social, cultural, political history of the overseas French Caribbean department. A history that also includes their peculiar relationship with the Hexagon or mainland France. First, as societies that emerged from the brutality of plantation slavery, I think it is important to use the works of scholars and intellectuals who specialize in the formation of these societies and take into consideration the various agents who participated in the construction of these societies, particularly the vast majority of marginalized Afro-French Caribbean people. Let's remember that there is a long history of ignoring the agency of the black masses in Martinique, Guadeloupe, and French Guiana. For example, only in 1981 did Edouard Glissant's Le Discours Antillais popularized the idea that Antillians actually revolted against the planters class, forcing them to abolish slavery weeks after the decree arrived from France. I also believe that the unique history of the French Caribbean, unique, it's very unique because we are talking about the eradication of entire societies and the formation of new ones in less than 400 years, right? So I believe that this very peculiar and unique history calls for transnational cultural, transnational intellectual exchange, particularly with intellectuals from societies sharing a similar tragic history and who also take seriously the experiences of marginalized subjects. For instance, the U.S., the United States, a republic like France, has produced a number of scholars who examine the implication of being a racialized other within a republic whose Declaration of Independence paradoxically states that all men are created equal and are entitled to life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness. So in terms of transnational intellectual exchange, I am thinking specifically of actually a scholar that Tyler mentioned last night, W.E.B. Du Bois, a scholar whose works is and was actually utilized by French Caribbean intellectuals like Aimé Césaire to make sense of their own world, but who is often ignored by most French historians interested in the French Caribbean. Yet, Du Bois' theoretical construct, for instance, the notion of double consciousness that he used to describe an individual whose identity is divided into several facets, is, I suggest, extremely relevant to reflect on the connection between French Caribbean identity and the writing of French Caribbean history. In many ways, it allows us to bridge the distance between the historians and the subjects. So, what facets of French Caribbean identity and culture can historians explore or utilize to better understand French Caribbean history or even French Caribbean relations with mainland France? So here I would suggest to pay close attention to folklore, because folklore, number one, is it's a window into a group's worldview. And remember that we are talking about a society or people that were mostly illiterate, right? Up until at least the turn of the 20th century. I also suggest paying close attention to the Creole language and, of course, music. According to numerous anthropologists and ethnomusicologists specializing in the African diaspora, Antillean's cultural expressions embody various political messages and shed light on the causes and complexities of social movements. Indeed, we should not minimize the fact that these black French citizens from the Americas are a product of the black Atlantic, and as scholars from C.L.R. James and Paul Gilroy have demonstrated, popular art is key for mobilizing le peuple and the struggle for socio-political change. I think music in particular is important for understanding, I mean, there are different categories, but clearly for understanding gender relations and notions of femininity in the French Caribbean. A student from the University of Chicago presented a paper in a previous panel about Indians and labor conflicts in Martinique. And so for race relations also, music is extremely important to understand race relations as far as the 19th century. And of course, for labor relations. And with each of these categories, as someone also from Martinique, I think of so many songs which we have not even utilized to begin to, you know, sort of understand various social phenomena that occurred throughout time. So to conclude, in addition to developing a greater sensitivity for, I think, let's call it interdisciplinary scholarship, using the works of linguists, anthropologists, ethnomusicologists, and Africana scholars, I also suggest to French historians that to attend Black Studies conferences, Africana Studies conferences, Caribbean Studies conferences, for instance, there's this wonderful conference in Senegal by the Caribbean Philosophical Association. And I'm saying this because, as someone who has trained in Africana Studies, coming to a French history conference, you know, I am exposed, obviously, to a different ways of thinking, different methodology. complicating my research, informing my research. Likewise, I think it is also important for French historians to do the same thing. Maybe you would be challenged, or maybe, you know, you will be it will reaffirm your research. Maybe you will say, okay, I was actually right. But you shall not know until you go. Thank you.
Merci, Felix. Thank you. Next, we will hear from Tyler Stovall, who is Distinguished Professor of History at the University of California, Santa Cruz, where he is also Dean of the Humanities Division. He's currently serving as President of the American Historical Association. He specializes in the history of modern France, in particular the study of labor, urban history, social history, race, and postcolonialism. Professor Stovall has written and edited several books on the subject, including The Rise of the Paris Red Belt, 1990, Paris Noir, African Americans in the City of Light, 1996, The Color of Liberty, Histories of Race in France, 2003, co-edited with Sue Peabody, here present, Transnational France, The Modern History of a Universal Nation, in 2015. He's currently on a global history of the relationship between freedom and race, tentatively entitled White Freedom, The Racial History of an Idea, which is forthcoming from Princeton University Press. Today he will talk about underrepresented minorities in the field of French history and diversifying the profession. Tyler.
Writing those two articles about these issues. One was an article I wrote quite recently for an edited volume in France. It was a study of American views of the Paris suburbs in the modern era and how they have changed recently. The basic theme of the article is that they've changed from a view of this, what people like to call boys in the banlieue, a sort of Afrocentric, ghetto-centric vision of the Paris suburbs, to a sort of Fallujah-sur-Seine model of the suburbs as a model of as a place of Islamic fundamentalism and Islamic outrage. But one of the things I learned in writing that article, and this should not be a surprise to anybody, was that I found that I was really looking much more into American racial attitudes than French attitudes. And it was very fascinating, especially looking into the issues of how the American embassy in Paris, whose secret diplomatic cables were thankfully leaked by WikiLeaks, viewed the issue, and viewed not just the issue of the Paris suburbs, but the issue of race in France and its relationship to France as a nation in general. The other article came out some years ago in an edited volume in Britain, and it's probably the best title I've ever written, Beyond Dead White Males, Toward a Post-Colonial History of Europe. I've gotten lots of comments, mostly praiseworthy, about that article, about that title at least. I don't think most people actually read the article, but they liked the title. But one group of people that did not like the article so much was members of my own department who were reviewing my case for a merit case, and they made lots of criticisms of it. And it was very interesting because after reading their criticisms, I basically concluded that, well, they saw themselves as dead white males and thought this was a personal attack. So this speaks to, this is a kind of microaggression that is all too common for scholars of color in academia, and especially for scholars of color who are people out of place, who exist in places where they are not seen as traditionally belonging. One of the things that you see in American universities is a tremendous emphasis on diversity, and I use the word again, diversity, inclusion. What you do not see is the use of a different set of words, which are older and more pointed, namely integration and segregation. There are lots of offices of diversity and inclusion in American universities. I have yet to hear of an office of desegregation in any American university. And yet, if you look at the structure of faculty representation in American universities, you can speak of extreme segregation, segregation that would not be tolerated in many other businesses, although it exists there as well. So one of the questions is how to address the representation of scholars of color within a political optic that talks about the structural existence of American universities and the structural representation of peoples within those universities. How to talk about not just diversity, which sort of, I always thought of like the United Colors of Benetton approach, that we've got, you know, we've different pants, different sizes, different colors, so on and so forth. But how to talk about really inclusion and exclusion and the politics of it. And that raises another question. Why have we moved away from these terms, which were certainly very powerful many years ago? Why is it that after supposedly years of attention to school integration, American schools, K-12, are more segregated than ever before? And why is there no outrage about that? To deal with this as an issue of integration and desegregation involves also a different look at resources. I'm a dean, so I deal with resources or the lack of resources on a daily basis. I'm at a university which has, on the one hand, proclaimed its mission to increase the number of faculty of color, which, on the other hand, is devoting virtually all of its new faculty FTE to the sciences. So, and nobody really seems to have addressed the fact that if you're looking at areas that do not have the pool, that have a diversity of representation, and that's where you're channeling your resources, all the things that you say about increasing diversity are going to be pretty much pointless, are not going to have the implications that you say you want to have, and are certainly not going to have the results that you say you wish for. So it is an issue of resources in general. At a time when the allocations to history departments, to humanities divisions, to social sciences divisions are increasingly challenged. In that kind of context, it is increasingly difficult to make the argument to departments that are looking to replace very, very important subfields that you have to give diversity a priority, that you have to give desegregation a priority in terms of your intellectual argument. This is not to say it should not be done and cannot be done, but it is also to say that in a realistic environment it is going to be much more difficult. So part of what has to be done, it seems to me, is to address the question of resources, to address the question of why and how do resources traditionally flow to areas where a representation of scholars of color is traditionally low, and what choices does that mean that universities are making when they choose to make that decision? Okay. So it is a resource question. It is also a question of simply intentionality and welcoming different scholars. It means that when you talk about integrating your profession, you have to be very aware of the messages that you are sending, that universities and departments are sending, in terms of how they group different fields, in terms of how they represent scholars in different fields. It means prioritizing, it seems to me, a diversity of experiences, a diversity of approaches to many different questions. So I wanted to speak about this because I wanted to congratulate the Society for undertaking this challenge, which I think is a very important one, and also notice that as a historian, this is not the first time this society has had a meeting like this. It did also about 20 or so years ago when I was first coming to the Western Society for French History, and it was one of the first scholarly organizations I knew of to address this kind of question. Let me point out one difference. When that meeting happened, and it was a very, very positive meeting, I think I was the only scholar of color in the room. That is no longer the case. And that in and of itself is a point worth noting and a point worth celebrating. And I think one of the things we need to do is take a look at back, okay, what has been done in the past 20 years or so that has had this achievement? Because I do think that it is not enough to say it is something that is important to do. It's also important to point out the gains that have been made, as well as the challenges that we continue to face, as a way of motivating ourselves to take on the challenges for the future. So I was talking earlier in another session about the importance of historians posing problems that they can confront and solve. It seems to me this is one of those problems. How can we solve the issue of greater diversity? in our profession. It seems to me that in the past, French history has been part of the problem, but it also seems to me that French history can and will be part of the solution. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tyler. Next, we will hear from Robin Mitchell, who is an assistant professor of history at the California State University, Channel Islands. She received her master's degree in late modern European history from UC Santa Cruz, her doctorate in late modern European history from UC Berkeley, with a designated emphasis on women, gender, and sexuality. She has published a number of articles and book chapters on the histories of black women in late modern France. Her first manuscript, entitled Venus Noire, Black Women, Colonial Fantasies, and the Production of Gender and Race in France, 1804 to 1848, will be published with the University of Georgia Press in December 2018. Today she will talk about othering and her experiences as a person of color who studies and teaches Europe and the subject of race. Robin.
Good morning. See, if my students didn't answer that good morning, I'd be very upset. Good morning. Thank you. Others will speak and have spoken about important questions about structural racism in French history, how we increase the number of underrepresented groups within our discipline. And like many of the colleagues that I'm sharing this podium with today, I can speak as being one of those underrepresented groups. As historians, we live and die by the stories that we find and the stories that we tell. So I'm going to tell you some stories before I ask my questions, which I hope will get folded in to the questions of my colleagues. So I began my graduate career lucky. Tyler Stovall was my advisor, and at Santa Cruz I met Jonathan Beecher, who rewarded my growing belief about the recurring theme of female-centered blackness in 19th-century canonical French novels by telling me to explore and share those discoveries with him in our independent study. And while I can say definitively that I never want to revisit Stendhal's protagonists in The Red and the Black, it was a wonderful way to begin my experience. Unfortunately, that didn't last very long. So as I shifted to Berkeley, picture 300 history graduate students in history, 17 of those African American, 3 of those African American women, and me in European history. The first 3 professors I met assumed my study before they had ever spoken to me, placing me well outside of Europe. They also seemed to find my theoretical frameworks rooted in interdisciplinary and intersectional feminism troubling. My colleagues said things like, "I don't need to study race. I study Europe." At one point in the middle of a class, I exclaimed in utter exasperation, "Yeah, pay no attention to the pesky slavery colonialism issue." I was super popular. When I began to study black women in late 18th and early 19th century France, the pushback, mostly from American scholars of France, was that I must be imposing American notions of race upon French history, as if I were not well trained enough to know the difference. This leads me to my first question. Who gets to tell the stories of race in France? Who gets to write these histories from spaces of perceived neutrality? And who is hyper-scrutinized? The constant and rather exhausting requirement to prove legitimacy in terms of our work angers me. So fast forward to my first experience teaching European history. I walked into a room and a young man gestured at me and exclaimed, "You're the teacher? I don't get it." The fact that this young man of 17, whom I subsequently referred to as that little shit, felt emboldened to question his newest professor. Notwithstanding, I'm happy to say my response was happily measured. Europe doesn't look like you think it does, which is why you don't get it. When I read Tyler Stovall's book, Paris Noir, as an undergraduate, it saved me. It put blacks on French soil. More importantly, it convinced me I wasn't crazy. And that's not a bad legacy, saving grad students from madness. It encouraged me to move backward, first into the 19th century and then into the 18th, to find other people, particularly women of African descent. And I found them. And surprise, surprise, some of them were even born there. How do we encourage our colleagues to learn something else? The small stories that challenge the meta-narratives, as Sue Peabody spoke of yesterday. How do we name our own biases and interrogate what Europe means and who is included? These are uncomfortable questions, and they should be uncomfortable. What teachings of Europe are taught to students which allow them to see Europe as a monolithic white space only taught by white people? And when I was putting this together, and I'll end with this, that the very realization that I am here because I saw Tyler, but I'm also here because Tyler saw me. Thank you.